Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Letty Klein. I'm a researcher and a writer and a former publisher. And it's my great honor this morning to have a discussion with our international guest, Harris Doutsometris, who've written the book with the very controversial title, The Man Who Killed Apartheid, The Life of Dimitri Stipendas. Just before we start, I want to say that Advocate George Bezos characterized this work on Stipendas as monumental and of being of major historical importance for South Africa. Professor John Dugard said, South African history should know the truth about Stipendas. Harris has done South Africa a service by correcting the historical record. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And for the opportunity to ask you a few questions on the research that you've conducted. So maybe to start off and putting things in context, this project is actually a double whammy. It's not just a book. You wrote a book, but you also handed a report with evidence to the Minister of Justice to
yes.
revisit this case.
Yes.
Within the South African context, it's quite timely with the reopening of the Timor case, as well as renewed questions on cases selected by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Tell us more about these two projects that you undertook.
I thought that because history has recorded Stipendas as an insane man who assassinated Dr. Farfoud for no political reasons, but simply because a tapeworm told him to do it, and it would be extremely difficult to change the history, no matter how many evidence I had, and I thought it would be impossible to include all the evidence in a book. So I thought that I should present the evidence to some jurists to evaluate them, and then to submit them to the South African authorities for further re-evaluation. So I thought it was important to have some jurists involved in the case. So before I submit the evidence to the minister, to the authorities, they could evaluate them, so to be sure that everything has been done properly and that I'm not evaluating the evidence in a wrong way. So I thought that in order to change the historical record about the assassination and to reveal exactly what happened, what the police did, but also what happened during the trial and after with the commission of inquiry into Dr. Farfoud's assassination, it was important to present all the evidence to the public. But before I take them to the public, I wanted to give them to the authorities. And I thought that the historical record could only change by presenting all the evidence to the people, so the people could see that what has been said is a lie. But obviously it is impossible in a book to include every single document that I found in the archives or all the interviews I conducted. So I wrote the report, I included all the evidence in the report, but I also gathered all the evidence in a USB stick and I gave them to, before I first gave them to them, my collaborators, the jurists, and then I gave them to the Minister of Justice. So, because I thought that an official announcement by the Minister of Justice, who is responsible for such cases, would be enough to, not enough, but it would be a first step from the government. And then I'm planning to, with the other jurists, to make an application to the court to, based on the new evidence, to re-examine and to put aside the findings of the Commission of Inquiry, where Judge Van Fake has manipulated the evidence in order to present, to misportray Stipendas and the assassination. So,
have you received a response yet?
The Minister of Justice attended the book launch in Johannesburg, and he did not refer to the report during the presentation, but he characterized the day, the event, as a day, as a moment to celebrate the truth about Stipendas. And afterwards, I spoke to him, and I asked him if he had read the report and if he had looked at the evidence. And he pointed to his assistant, to his advisor, and he said that he did it. And I have gone to that he has gone through some of the evidence, but he hasn't finished the report. So I asked him, what do you think? And he said, word by word, we wouldn't have been here if we disagreed with your conclusions. So he said, well, his advisor then said that they have gone through all the evidence, they have gone through the report, they agree that with my conclusions, and that they're going to make an announcement soon, and that they were in talks with the Minister of Education about how to proceed with the matter further. This is what happened in November. So now Judge Zak Yacoub is going to write a letter to the minister to ask him to hurry up a little with them.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So you've dedicated close to a decade of your life on this research. What is it that motivated you or that first triggered the project?
Initially, it was just curiosity to find out more about Tsafendas. But while I kept on looking for more information about him, I kept on thinking that a major injustice has happened for the way that he has been portrayed by the media and also by history. And I spoke to four priests, one in Istanbul, who met Tsafendas in 1961, and he lived in the same house with Tsafendas for 4 months, and for the next 3 months they were together practically every day. Then there was another priest who met Tsafendas in 1963 in Mozambique, and he associated closely with him while Tsafendas was in Mozambique in 1963 and in 1965, and he visited Tsafendas in prison from the late 1970s until almost he died. And two other priests, one who met Tsafendas in 1989, and he kept on visiting him until 1994, and the fourth priest visited Tsafendas for the first time in 1994. He saw him on two occasions then, and then only once again before he died. But all these priests, the three of them knew each other, but the one in Istanbul didn't know about the others. They told me the same things about Tsafendas. And I found it very strange that these were priests, and some of them were quite conservative, but they were speaking extremely high of Tsafendas, about his character, not about the assassination, because they all condemned the assassinations. And they had conversations with Tsafendas where they clearly told him that what he did was wrong. But despite the fact that Tsafendas had killed a man, the priest was speaking extremely high of him. And also, on some occasions, they were crying when they were talking about Tsafendas. So I found it very strange that, you know, this priest will speak so high about somebody who had committed the murder, when to kill a man is a major sin in Christianity. So I began thinking that this motivated me even more. And some of the things that they told me, for example, when Tsafendas confided to two of them about the Tsafendas confined to three of them, but one of the priests does not allow me to quote the one who is the bishop of the Greek Orthodox Church in Pretoria, Father Michalis Visvinis. He was visiting Tsafendas for 5 years. He allowed me to quote him talking generally about Tsafendas, but he hasn't allowed me to use everything that Tsafendas told him. So Tsafendas confined to the other two priests about the assassination, and what he told them motivated him even more about the assassination and why he did it, what he thought of her food, and all this were slowly, gradually made me want to investigate the case more. But I thought that just to write a book about Tsafendas will not be enough to correct the historical record, and this needed to be done by taking all the evidence and giving them to the authorities. At the time I was doing my PhD, and I interviewed for my PhD, not for Tsafendas, Michael Dukakis, who was the former governor of Massachusetts. And while he was governor, he personally instructed his legal team to examine the Sacco and Vanzetti case, because he believed that they were innocent. And to cut a long story short, we were talking about Sacco and Vanzetti, so I told him the story about Tsafendas. And he said that the best thing to do is to find the evidence keep on with the research, and once you find the evidence, you have to give them to the authorities, and the authorities will decide what to do and whether you agree, etc. So,
okay. Thank you. So the filmmaker Lisa Key wrote in a note accompanying some flowers that went to the very bizarre funeral of Sapenda's.
Yes.
She described him as a displaced person, a sailor, Christian, communist, a liberal fighter, political prisoner, and a hero. You've spent a decade tracing this man. What kind of a human being have you discovered?
I think this quotation fits Tsafendas perfectly and describes him as accurate as possible. To describe Tsafendas' character, I would say that he was an extremely intelligent person. His IQ was 115 or 18, I can't remember. It is in the book. Because it was measured during before the trial. He was a very caring man. He was also, though, very manipulative. And at one point of his life, he admitted it, being a coward, during the Second World War. He was assigned to serve in the Liberty ships, and Tsafendas was terrified that if he go to one of the ships, he might be torpedoed, the ship will sink, and he will drown. So he didn't want to do this, and he was absolutely certain that he was afraid that he would die. So he did everything possible during the Second World War to avoid serving. And he was very embarrassed about this. He felt, it was a shameful and disgusting behavior. And that's why afterwards he also wanted to redeem himself for what he did. And he said that he only realized what a coward he was when he watched the newsreel about the liberation of the Nazi camps from the Soviets and from the Americans, and he realized what the Nazis had done, and that he had ashamed the family, because his whole family was full of revolutionaries who had fought during the Greek War of Independence, and Tsafendas had grown up in a very revolutionary environment, mostly influenced by his father, who was an anarchist, and his grandmother, all her siblings had died fighting the Ottomans in Crete. So afterwards, Tsafendas was looking for a chance to redeem, let's say, himself. Now, on the other hand, Tsafendas was quite generous as well, and he very often helped people who were in need, and he had very deep communist beliefs. And he believed that all people should are equal, and they should have equal opportunities, and they should not be discriminated in any way. And he thought that education was the most important thing in their lives. That's why he taught Mozambican children, but also children in Istanbul, history and English, because he thought that education was the most important thing that they could obtain in order to get away, to escape from their poverty. But also in Mozambique, he thought that the people should get educated in order to revolt against the Portuguese. And he was quite funny and very sarcastic. And a lot of people have been saying how he was often making jokes also about himself being fat, big, and also ugly. He was making fun, he had some iron teeth. So he was very easy to joke and to laugh. And some people believe that he also took up advantages of other people, which I think he did to some extent, because Tsafendas was the kind of person who he thought that he was very open and willing to help people. So he believed that other people should also be like this with him. So some of the people did not see it this way, and he thought that he was going far, and especially with his family was extremely upset with him, because he lied to them in order to, his family knew that he was a passionate communist and that he was banned from entering South Africa and Mozambique because of his political activities in the past. And when he met them in 1963, he lied to his mother, to his stepmother, and to his siblings that he was a reformed man, that he was not going to get involved anymore into politics. He was going to keep his mouth shut. This is the words he used to his mother. And he assured them that he was not going to cause them any trouble. And a week later, while they were in Pretoria, he overheard the priest, while they were attending a Sunday Mass, he heard the priest praising apartheid, and Tsafendas started talking against apartheid with the priest. So there was a kind of a big argument in the church about apartheid. So the family was quite embarrassed, and they realized that Tsafendas has not changed his opinions, and that he's going to cause them problems again. But Tsafendas behaved himself until he left Mozambique. So he left for Mozambique. So his behavior was quite reckless, and often he was a person who could not keep his mouth shut. Although his father was an anarchist and equally passionate about politics, perhaps even more than Tsafendas, his father was very, not secretive, but he was very careful when he was talking, especially publicly. But Tsafendas was the opposite, and as a lot of people said, he just, if he saw something that was wrong, he had to intervene, and he had to say it out loud, and he had to go and confront the person who said something that he didn't agree with. So, yeah, this is what, yeah.
So, you're the first person to have access to the family yes. for your research. So, is there anything really interesting that came out of those discussions with the family? And then following on that, how did the assassination affect the family?
The family was very reluctant to talk about Tsafendas, and after the assassination, the loss, they completely forgot him. They went through some very difficult times, and their lives were basically ruined. And they were constant for several months after the assassination, they feared that they might be deported. And the family was very well aware of Tsafendas' political, obviously, ideology and of his past activities. And his stepmother, as soon as they heard the news, she went to his room and she took all the books he had, records, and even family photographs, and she burned them. Because she feared that the police was going to search the house, and she didn't want to have any evidence suggesting that Tsafendas was close to the family. After the assassination, his brother never got he was working for Iskor in Pretoria, and he never got a promotion. One of the sisters was living at the time in Rhodesia, and she had a supermarket there, and she lost all her customers. And she only had a few Greeks. All the local non-Greeks stopped going to her shop. And the other sister also had a coffee shop in Pretoria. She also lost all the customers. And for several years they were struggling to survive, but they had no other option to leave because they had nothing in Greece. So they were forced to stay. But gradually things started improving. But his sister told me in Rhodesia that for several months hadn't left the house, and hadn't even left the house to go for shopping. It was only her husband who was going to do all the shopping and everything. And she said that, I can't remember now the date, I think I have included it in the book. She said that she went 2 or 3 years afterwards on a Christmas party that was organized by the Greek community in Rhodesia, and as soon as she entered the room, everyone turned, they stopped talking, and they were pointing at her that she was Tsafendas' sister. And when she sat down, people went and they started talking to her, asking her about Tsafendas and what a terrible thing he did, etc., etc., etc. So the family, the family's lives were deeply affected, and they lived with fear for some time, because I forgot to tell you also that their houses were also attacked, and stones and eggs were thrown in their houses, and also they broke the walls, they broke the windows in one of the coffee shops that they owned. So the family tried to distance themselves as possible as from Tsafendas. Now, in 1994, Jody Kolapen, who is now a High Court judge in Pretoria, at the time was a lawyer for the Lawyers for Human Rights, was asked by the head warden of Pretoria Central Prison to go and see Tsafendas, because this man was very sympathetic towards Tsafendas. So Kolapen went to see him, and to cut a very long story short, he lobbied for Tsafendas to be released from prison. So he went to the family and he asked them that if they would look after Tsafendas if he was released, and the family said no. So Kolapen then went to the Greek community and he asked the local Greek community if they would look after Tsafendas, if they would put him in a Greek people's home or in an old people's home which belonged to the Greek church. But the Greek community also said no. So Kolapen then went back to the family. He asked them again, and the family said no again. So then Kolapen wrote a letter to the government asking them to interfere, because he believed that if a member of the government went to see the family, they might change their minds. So somebody from the government went to see the family, but the family again said, no, we don't want to do anything. We don't want to have anything to do with Tsafendas. But the whole truth is also that at the time, Tsafendas' siblings were in the mid-70s, and they were not even able to look after themselves. They had people looking after themselves. Obviously, this is not an excuse, because still they could have they were quite wealthy, so they could have provided, they could have put Tsafendas in a private institute or somewhere. Anyway, so the family kept on being very aggressive towards Tsafendas. Apart, I should clarify actually that Tsafendas' brothers-in-law were not like this. They were very sympathetic with what Tsafendas did, and not exactly what he did, but they understood his motive. Yes. But also they were very sympathetic with him as a person and with his personality. And it was one of the brothers, Nick Vlachopoulos, who gave Tsafendas an apartment for free, and Tsafendas stayed there for several months in Pretoria, and this man also gave him a job in his coffee shop. And the other brother-in-law, Charles Nisiotis, he gave like a guarantee to the government, something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but when Tsafendas applied for permanent residence in South Africa, this man provided him with a statement that he will be responsible for Tsafendas or something. To cut a long story short, Tsafendas' family was reluctant to talk about what happened. But some of the members had very good relationship with Father Michalis Visvinis, the Greek Orthodox priest in Pretoria. So it was him who got in touch with Tsafendas' nephew, Mike Vlachopoulos, who he somehow convinced his auntie, Tsafendas' stepsister, to talk to me. And when I spoke to her, she was still very angry about Tsafendas, and she kept on saying that Tsafendas ruined her life. And she was talking, the things that she was saying about Tsafendas were for her negative, but somebody would think that they were positive. For example, she was saying that he had crazy ideas at the time. He believed that the Portuguese should leave Mozambique, so for her this was a crazy idea. Or that people in South Africa should revolt and should kick the apartheid regime away, etc., etc., etc. So Tsafendas' political ideas for her were crazy and aggressive and provocative. And but slowly, while we were talking, she started becoming softer. And when I saw her some of the documents from the archives I found, she hadn't watched the... No, she had watched the documentary, but she hadn't watched the Rashes from Liza Keys documentary. She became even much softer, so then she began talking, and she invited me for dinner, then she invited me for another dinner, and we spent 3 or 4 days, almost 7 or 8 hours each day, talking about Tsafendas. And she was very helpful, And by the time we finished, she had not forgiven him, because still she believed that Tsafendas ruined her life. But and she also considered what Tsafendas did was wrong, and that he shouldn't have done it. But she was softer towards him, and she was willing to help, because she admitted that the way Tsafendas has been portrayed is wrong, and that he was not the kind of person he has, to be apolitical and mad. So she was willing to talk and to help. And his other family also is very, very helpful. His distant family was much more helpful, especially those in Crete.
Yes. Okay, so the South African PhD candidate, Zugleika Adams, wrote that Tsafendas is largely absent in South African historiography. Not a single scholar in the discipline has considered his life or his actions worthy of detailed historical analysis. Yet there is a substantial body of archival material on Tsafendas. Why, in your view, is it that in both cases where we have book publications on Tsafendas, they were done by outsiders? So first Henk van Vuren from the Netherlands, and now you.
I'm not sure. I cannot explain it. I don't know. I'm sorry.
I'm going to follow that up by a question where David Reeve writes in his book In Praise of Forgetting that whichever interpretation prevails at a given time is a function of power, not truth. Is there something ingrained in the psyche of the Afrikaner that leans towards the art of wanting to forget? And I'll follow that up with an example. When the English translation of van Vuren's book, A Mouthful of Glass, appeared in South Africa, it was awarded with the Sunday Times Alan Paton Award. When the Afrikaans translation appeared, it was a complete trashing in reviews, as well as pretty much a character assassination on Ankie Kroah. Why do you think is it that, and is it also a pattern that you think is currently following your publication, that the English media is presenting this in a more positive manner or reporting more positively on this than the Afrikaans media?
I'm not sure about what happened in the past with Van Worden's book, but the Afrikaner press has not criticized the book. On the contrary, several publications have praised the book. And the people I spoke to, the Afrikaner people I spoke to, also have praised the book. The comments I have seen that are negative are by people who have commented on the reviews by the Afrikaner journalists. But I haven't seen any report in the media criticizing the book. I cannot explain exactly now why some people will... because this is not about Afrikaners or British or Greek or whatever people. This is just about something that happened a long time ago, and it is about a person's life who was born in Mozambique and he has been mistreated by history. The book is not about Tsafendas being a good man and Afrikaners being bad, or English being bad, or whatever. This is about Tsafendas and the assassination. It just happens that the person who got assassinated, the Prime Minister at the time, was Afrikaner. But in the book, and Tsafendas was not racist towards Afrikaners. He had Afrikaners friends, and also he described in detail how an Afrikaner warden helped him while he was in Pretoria prison. And he speaks very highly of him in Liza Key's documentary by crying, by saying that this man was not like the other man. He says that, I can't remember now what was the name of the, I think it was Pretorius, I'm not sure, or something, who the chief warden who was beating Tsafendas up while he was in prison. But then he says that there was another warden who was very sympathetic with me, etc., etc., etc. And also the person who contacted Kolapen and asked him to go and check Tsafendas, who was sympathetic with Tsafendas, the chief warden, was also Afrikaner. Now, if some Afrikaners are getting offended, it's like because Tsafendas killed for food, it's like somebody German getting offended because somebody said something bad about Hitler. I don't think Germans who hear someone talking bad about Nazism or about I don't think. I'm sure Germans do not get offended if somebody says something bad about Hitler or about Nazis. And also, I don't get offended. I am Greek. If somebody says, "Oh, the Greek dictator was a horrible man. He was a dictator. He oppressed people, etc." It is a fact. This is what he did. He was Greek. I am Greek. Doesn't mean that I have any connection with him or that I will close my eyes and say, "Oh, he's Greek. He was a good man." He was a dictator. He was Greek, and he oppressed the Greek people at the time, and it is a fact. Now, the Greeks who will get offended by someone talking negative about this man, about the dictator, is people who have obviously sympathies with this person, with or with Hitler or with the Greek dictator, etc.
Let's talk some conspiracy theory. What are some of the conspiracy theories that exist? And please refer to the tapeworm as well as the Lang Hendrik van der Berg / Foster initiative to get him into power that your research uncovered as untrue.
In the report that I submitted to the minister, there is a very detailed examination of all the conspiracy theories that about the brainwashing, or that van den Berg somehow allowed its offenders this to happen, and none of them is true. I don't have any evidence. I didn't find any evidence to suggest that any of this is true. All the evidence I found have been presented. And it's very, very easy to dismiss all of these theories, not only because of the absence of any evidence to support the theories, but also by going back and looking at some of the origins of these theories and how they began. For example, the brainwashing theory, and that van den Berg, General van den Berg, was responsible, started by I can't remember what his first name, Hubbard, who was the founder of Scientology. And in 1966, before the assassination of Erfurt, she wrote a letter to Dr. Farfud. I can't remember exactly what he said in the letter. I can send you the report and read it, see what I have written, or if anyone else wants to see what happened. She wrote a letter to Dr. Farfud telling him that, asking him to help in the fight against communism or something. And after the assassination of Farfud, this sounds unrealistic, but this is exactly what happened. I can show you the documents. A gentleman called McMaster wrote a letter to John Foster telling him that it is very possible that Tsafendas was hypnotized to assassinate Farfud, and that foreign powers might have hired Tsafendas to do it. And he said that in his organization, they have the people in the Scientology group, they have a special training that allows them to not be hypnotized or been affected like this by communist people who can hypnotize other people. So he told Foster that he is willing to train all the civil servants and everyone working for the government so they won't be hypnotized like offenders. But he didn't offer any evidence. So, yeah, this is how the story began, and then afterwards again somebody said, oh, Tsafendas was hypnotized, because this man made the theory that Tsafendas was probably hypnotized, and he asked the government basically for contracts to train the people. I know it's, you're laughing. I will show you the document afterwards to see. This is what happened.
The second conspiracy theory, which is the big one, the tapeworm. Take us through that.
When Tsafendas was arrested, he immediately told the police both of his statements were found in the archives. That one, he was disgusted with apartheid policy, and that by killing Farfud, he hoped that sooner or later a change of policy would take place. And he also said that he considered Dr. Verfoed to not be the real representative of all the South African people, and that he wanted to see a government that will represent all the South African people. In both statements, there is no mention of the tapeworm, there is no mention of anything to suggest that Tsafendas was insane or even slightly deranged. I have given both statements to several psychiatrists, forensic psychiatrists as well, who agree with this. So Tsafendas, up until the 18th or the 19th of September, 13 days after the assassination, he still gives the police political reasons for killing Dr. Verfoed. Then something happens and he changes his tune. Now, this is not evident in the archives, because in the National Archives in Pretoria, you can only find the two statements that Tsafendas gave to the police. And then suddenly, Tsafendas is seen by his lawyers, and he starts talking to them about a tapeworm. The priest asked Tsafendas how the tapeworm came to being, and all he said was that he couldn't take the torture anymore. And he described the torture and what happened to him while he was in custody. And Tsafendas said that he was convinced that he was going to be killed while he was in custody. He said that he was expecting to be tortured, but he was expecting to go to a trial, to speak against, to support what he did, to claim political responsibility for what he did, and then to be hanged. And he said to the police in his statement that, "I didn't care about the consequences and what would happen to me. I was so disgusted with the apartheid policies that I went through with my plan to kill the prime minister." So, but while he's in custody, he's severely tortured. He was electrocuted, he was beaten up, but the worst thing that happened was that they were going to his cell, they were carrying him to another room, and then they were putting a hoodie around him, and they were saying to him, "Now, bastard, your time has come." And they were putting a rope around his neck, and they were putting him on a chair, they were kicking the chair, and Tsafendas was left hanging. And the policemen were laughing, and they were keep on saying, "Oh, now your time came, you will die, bastard," etc., etc., etc. And after a few seconds, they were letting him fall. And they were kept on laughing, and they were saying, "Oh, that your time hasn't come yet, but you're not getting out of here alive." So Tsafendas became convinced that he was going to be hanged in the prison while he was in custody, and then the police will claim that he was insane. And he thought that this is what happened also with David Pratt. He believed that David Pratt was killed while he was in the hospital, and then the police said that he committed suicide. So he thought, Tsafendas said that he was afraid to have an undignified death. And he believed that if he was killed in prison by such a way, and then it was revealed that he was insane and that he killed Verfoed for no political reasons, this will undermine his act. So he thought that he should remain alive, and he pretended to be mad. I'm not sure exactly what he did, because he never said. He just said that he was embarrassed to talk about what he did and about the tapeworm. And he thought that it was an act of cowardice that he did it, but he said that he couldn't take the torture, and because he was afraid to have such death, he pretended to be mad. And this is what I believe. I don't have evidence to prove it, but I believe that also the government at the time, the police, wanted Tsafendas, and they drove him towards claiming that he was insane, because the police knew that Tsafendas in the past had pretended to be mad. They had a document from 1943 from the Grafton State Hospital which said clearly that Tsafendas had pretended to be mad in order to not serve in the ships. And they also knew that in 1965, he had again pretended, when he was arrested by the Portuguese, while he had spent 3 months in prison, he had claimed to be Saint Peter, Jesus Christ Apostle, in order to be released. So the police were aware that twice in the past, Tsafendas was arrested, and twice in the past, he had claimed to be insane, and then he was released. So perhaps, as I said, I don't have any evidence, but it is an assumption, the police also aware that Tsafendas was, this was something that he did in the past, drove him to do this.
Although outside of the scope of your research, did you find anything sinister on the suicide of David Pratt?
No. I also researched, not as extensively as I did with Tsafendas, the David Pratt case, but his case also has many similarities with Tsafendas. And David Pratt is a completely different person to the one that was portrayed by the press. And the government at the time, 2 days after the assassination, issued a ban on the press from writing anything about David Pratt and mentioned his name. And this was the same day when a British newspaper, I can't remember which one, I think it's the Daily Express, published in the first page a picture with David Pratt along with a member of the Liberal Party going outside 10 Downing Street canvassing for the Liberal Party for the elections. And also the overseas press speaking extensively about how David Pratt was very politically involved. He was a financier of the British anti-apartheid movement and of the Liberal Party. And also here in South Africa, he had built modern houses for his black workers. And he had also built a school for the children of his black employers, which still exists, the Maloney's Eye. And he was very quite active with the British anti-apartheid movement and the Liberal Party. But none of this was reported at the time to the press because the press was silenced by the government. So the picture that emerged was again that Pratt was somebody with no political interest, that he had epilepsy, which he had epilepsy, but he was politically motivated and for what he did. And afterwards, again, this is a very long, different story. Pratt also felt that his behavior when he was during the trial was cowardice, and he wanted his case to be reopened. So he wrote to a judge asking him to re-examine his case, and he wanted to be tried. And he asked several witnesses to come to testify on his behalf, and they accepted. Very prominent witnesses like Jeremy Thorpe of the Liberal Party in Britain to come and testify on his behalf, who knew him. And I spoke to a gentleman, his name is Michael Middlecroft. He's a former British member of the parliament with the Liberal Party, who didn't meet David Pratt, but he's the chairman of the, I can't remember now what the name of the club, it's Liberal National Club or something, which is a private club in England, where Churchill, Lloyd, several former British prime ministers were members, and David Pratt was also a member. And in order to become a member, you had to be a liberal, politically active, and also to have some references. So this gentleman, Michael Middlecroft, went to, because the archives of this club are private, but he went to the archives, he found all the documents regarding Pratt, and also he found the minutes from all the discussions that the members of the club had after the assassination, and they all were very supportive for Pratt, not for what he did, but for Pratt as a person. And there wasn't the slightest indication that Pratt was insane or
wanted to commit suicide.
Yes. And people who knew him, and I spoke to a journalist called Desmond Blow, who was a Sunday Times reporter at the time, and he became very close to Pratt while Pratt was in the hospital. And he gave me all his private collection of letters that Pratt wrote to him and some other documents regarding Pratt. And again, there isn't any the slightest indication that Pratt was insane or that he didn't know what... He was perfectly sane, and also what he did was for political reasons.
I think this is a very convoluted case all around. And I think... For me, the same happened when A Mouthful of Glass first became available in South Africa. And I think the part that was most moving to me in the Lisa Key documentary was, can somebody just buy Tsafendas a clean robe? Because you cannot but feel sorry for this individual if you see the actual state that he's in. So what von Buden wrote was that the grave being dug in a corner used for interring the poorest of the poor, vagrants, and those without next of kin, which is not true, I later found out. And the burial place has since remained unmarked. No tombstone has been erected above it. No sign identifies the spot. It has simply disappeared among the mounds, rubble, and tangled grass in the immediate vicinity. So obviously I wanted to know this is actually true. And I did find the grave in the Munzeville Stadfontein Cemetery, and the one really interesting thing that strikes me that you might not be able to see that clearly on the screen is the two little red circles, because it's again one of those laughable instances where we do quick fixes. So they lifted the fence between the black and the white cemeteries and then deleted by painting over the arrows that points to the different cemeteries, that actually not getting it right, so you can see the little arrows going. This is the grave site of Safenas. I don't know. Have you been there?
I have been, yes.
So he's buried between a De Bruyne and a Bezuidenhout in a quite expensive part of the cemetery where you're not allowed to just erect a headstone. You actually have to have a full slate on that. So a few years ago, I undertook a research project on reflective conversations that matched every single one of the themes in that, which was typography, topography, and typology. And we actually, as part of this transdisciplinary practice-led research project, I did the research part, and then the former typographer, Tini de Plessis, designed a tombstone for Safenas. Edzard de Plessis actually created this tombstone, and we had that on exhibition with the project. Now, I distinctly remember the day I sat at the dinner table with my mother telling her about this project and how hard she put down her cutlery and how the INJPs were rolling over the table saying, you are going to put up a tombstone for a murderer and call it research. And my very non-political capitalist brother is saying, that's just a waste of my tax money, because that's what you academics actually do. And then at the opening, where this tombstone was then on display as an artwork, one of my former professors approached me and said, out of all the things you can do to us, you did this. So I'm quite aware also of the politics around that. And the grave is still unmarked, and according to South African politicians, it will remain that way. What more needs to be done to change the perspective that are, no pun intended, really set in stone about Safenas?
Okay, first of all, what von Horden has written, I'm not sure if it is accurate, because what he wrote was 1999, so it could have been like this. At the time, when I visited the grave, it was exactly as you just shown in the picture. I think, as for what people say about your mom's reaction, I cannot understand it, because I understand that, okay, you can condemn Safenas and you can say what he did was wrong. Okay, I agree 100%. It was wrong, but I don't think that somebody could have. Well, obviously people will have some sympathy for Verfoed because he was assassinated, but to act like this because Verfoed was killed, or to sympathize with Verfoed's ideas, I think, because such a reaction suggests that perhaps the people have some sympathy with Verfoed's ideas, because otherwise I don't think that people would care about somebody being killed by someone else and would act this way. I cannot explain it. So I think that, as I told you before, with somebody in Greece in 1967 attempting to assassinate the Greek dictator at the time, he didn't succeed. He failed. So this man was tortured, etc., etc. And afterwards, the Greek government recognized this person, the attempted assassin, as a hero, despite the fact that, you know, he failed and also he attempted to kill a person. And there is a statue of him in a metro station. Now, a lot of people could say that what this man did is wrong, attempting to kill somebody, and that he shouldn't have attempted it. But you have to acknowledge that the person, the victim, was not someone who had, let's say, democratic values, and who a lot of people could agree and would accept that the Ferfud would not have been targeted if, let's say, he was no Ferfud, wrong example. There wouldn't have been an attempted assassination if Ferfud had no such policies. For example, it would have been different if you tried to assassinate Mbeki or Zuma or Ramaphosa or Mandela or whatever, because of the policies. But Ferfud at the time was not seen as an ideal politician, and his policies were considered to be a crime against humanity. The United Nations acknowledged that what Ferfud and Foster was doing was a crime against humanity. In an ideal world, Ferfud, Foster and Botta should have been brought on trial to the International Court of Justice, and they would have been in prison forever because they were criminals by the standards of the international law. So, but at the time, for various reasons, obviously the international community didn't pursue to arrest Foster, although the United Nations accepted that he was committing a crime against humanity. So, since somebody commits a crime against humanity, I'm not justifying the murder, okay? But I'm just saying that people should accept that what Ferfud was doing was wrong. And
I think my mom should just accept that erecting a tombstone is not erecting a statue. There's a huge difference to making or marking a grave for future references to be able to find that, because it wasn't easy finding that grave.
Of course it's not.
So just marking it is something completely different to erecting a statue. Before we go over to questions, I want to ask you, in conclusion, Sathenas himself was a great storyteller, as you've also said, very humorous and so forth. He was an avid reader. He could speak multiple languages. He even worked as a translator. But he also had an ambition to one day write about his life. So while being detained on death row, he continuously wrote to prison authorities requesting proper medical attention, books, and a musical instrument to help him pass the time. In one of those letters, and there's 44 letters in the archive that Sathenas wrote while being incarcerated, that was addressed to the double agent Gordon Winter, he talked about his formal education at the Technical College in Johannesburg that he had attended in 1941. And there's a little bit of context, but the part I want to focus on is the part in red, which is quite a hard rendering for me. He also writes that, "This is just a glimpse of my experience in an abnormal world. I intend writing a book if ever I have the opportunity, but medical attention is what I need at present." Do you feel that you've done justice with this book to Sathenas' wish, and that we now finally have an accurate and definitive work on his life?
Okay. I will start with the letters, first of all. Sathenas, I have all the letters. I have everything that was that is in the archives. In 1980s, Sathenas asked Father Minas Konstantinou, who was visiting him at the time, to write some letters to some of his friends. So Father Minas said to him, "Why don't you write them yourself? And I will give you the money to post them." And he said, no, you have to do it yourself. I will tell you what to say, and you will write it." So Father Minas sat down, and Sathenas was telling him what to write. He wrote several letters, and everything that Sathenas wrote was perfectly logical. Now, in 1994, when Tsafendas was in Pretoria Central Prison's hospital, and after apartheid had collapsed, sometime after apartheid had collapsed, Father Minas visited him again. So Tsafendas said to him, Father, will you please lend me some money? Because I want to write some letters to my friends. And the priest got surprised and he said, of course, Dimitris, I will give you money. But what happened? How come now you're going to write the letters yourself from here, and all the previous years I was writing them myself? And he said, my father, all the previous years during apartheid, the wardens were reading my letters. So if I had written a letter at the time, they would have expected to see signs of my condition and references to the tapeworm. Now, if I had written such letters to convince the wardens that, you know, I'm like this, my friends outside, they would have thought that I really have gone mad. So that's why I couldn't write the letters myself. But now that they do not read my letters, I will write them myself. So going back now to the other issue regarding what you said about Tsafendas' future, Tsafendas was very humble and he didn't want the world to know what he did. Once he spoke to the priest, there were two priests at the time, Father Minas Konstantinou and Father Ioannis Tsaftaridis. Father Ioannis Tsaftaridis is the one who is now Bishop of the Greek Orthodox Church in Zambia, before he was in Mozambique. To cut a long story short, he confided to them, and Ioannis was very young at the time. So he asked him in the beginning, Tsafendas asked the priest, do you know what apartheid was? And he said, of course, Mr. Tsafendas, I've read about it. And he said, no, you don't know anything. You cannot read about it. In order to understand its real extent, you had to be black and to live among blacks to see what it really was. And while they were talking then about the assassination, Tsafendas, the priest, Minas, was telling Tsafendas that what he did was wrong. And Tsafendas was trying to justify it by saying that Ferfoy was a tyrant, a dictator, he was oppressing his people, etc., etc., etc. And in the end, Tsafendas told Minas, listen, you see every man you see a man who is committing a serious crime on which millions of people are affected. You cannot take this man to the court, and you cannot take him to the police, because he is the law in the country. What will you do? Will you let him continue with the crime, or will you do something to stop him? So the priest said, I will want to stop him, Dimitris, but I will not go and kill him. So Tsafendas says, this is the only way to stop him. By killing him, there's no any other way. So afterwards, Ioannis, the youngest priest, who was very shocked with everything that Tsafendas was saying, said to him, we're going to tell Mr. Tsafendas the word about you. And Tsafendas said, no, you should not tell anyone about me. If you tell someone, it is like undermining my act. I'm very happy with what I did. My conscience is clear. And I'm sure God will understand when I die why I did it. And I will justify it only to him. He's the only person I need to justify it. To cut a long story short, Tsafendas insisted that they should not tell his story. So he didn't want this to become known. And afterwards, before Tsafendas died, he was visited again by Ioannis and another priest called Spiros Randos. And Tsafendas asked him to do a favor for him. Very long story now to explain the favor, but again, Ioannis told him, we're going to tell the world about what you have done and who you are. And Tsafendas said, no, you all have to do only what I told you. Don't do anything else. So all the following years, there was a sort of an argument between the priests about what to do, because Ioannis wanted to tell the people about what they knew about Tsafendas, but the other two priests thought that they should respect Tsafendas' wish to not reveal what he told them. And one of them also believed that they should not reveal what Tsafendas had told them, because they were priests, and although this was not in a form of confession, and Tsafendas was like a believer who was confiding to them. And this is the reason why Father Michalis Visvinis in Pretoria hasn't allowed me to reveal. Although he told me everything that Tsafendas told him, he said to me, if you ever get into trouble, or if it is absolutely necessary for me to reveal what Tsafendas have told me, I will come out and say it. But you have already enough from the other priests. He said, I don't want to reveal publicly what Tsafenda said, because he didn't want this thing to be revealed. And also, I believe it is wrong, me as a priest, to reveal what Tsafenda told me. So over the following years, there was a conflict between the, not constant conflict, but there was some discussion about whether to reveal these things or not. And so Tsafenda did not want his story to be told. So I violated basically Tsafenda's wish, but I believe that Tsafenda, I should have done it, and I did the right thing for doing it, because Tsafenda was a humble man, and I understand his position, but I thought that it is an injustice, people to believe that Tsafenda was this kind of person that he was, and that the truth about him, and not only about the assassination, but also about his previous political, especially his political activities, which were a lot, that they should be revealed. And people should not be looking at him as an insane, apolitical idiot who killed Dr. Ferfut because a tapeworm told him to do it. So I think I did, yes, what I could with Tsafenda's, and I hope he,
yeah. Another he double whammy. Thank you very much. Can we take maybe one or two questions from the floor? Yes, sir. Can you just wait for the mic, please? Thank you.
Yes, the Ferfut government was heavily anti-communist, and Tsafenda was a communist. Did that also play a role in his motivation for killing Ferfut, or was it, you think, only purely because of being against apartheid?
thank you very much. I don't think that communism had any role to play in the case. It was simply because of his despise against apartheid and against Ferfut. And Tsafenda initially did not want to kill Ferfut. He wanted to kidnap him and exchange him with political prisoners. But he was not able to find any support with anyone who would join him. So he ended up killing him. But no, the fact that I cannot say 100%. I have never asked such a question. But from what Tsafenda said to the police in his statement, and also from what he told the people afterwards, he only did it because he believed that a change of policy would take place, that apartheid will collapse sooner or later after the assassination.